Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our first seminar for 2011. A momentous year it's been to date, and I'm sure, well, I hope we don't have the type of excitement we've had in the last month or so. I'm sure we'll have lots of excitement. And Andrew O'Neill, Professor Andrew O'Neill, is about to start off the exciting start as far as our association is concerned tonight. Andrew is Professor of International Relations and also the Director of the Griffith Asia Institute at Griffith University. He is the author of a very wide range of journal articles and book chapters in the areas of international security and strategy. He's also the author of a learned tome, Nuclear Proliferation in Northeast Asia, The Quest for Security. Prior to joining Griffith, Andrew was Associate Professor in the School of Political and International Studies at Flinders University in South Australia. He has worked as a strategic analyst with Australia's Defence Intelligence Organisation, and in 2009 he was appointed Editor-in-Chief of the Australian Journal of International Affairs, which of course is Australia's leading scholarly outlet for international relations research. So once again, it is a great pleasure indeed to welcome Andrew to address us. And this, on this occasion, of course, Andrew is going to be talking to us about, the Korean Peninsula. I'll put it that way and let Andrew expand. Andrew will be very pleased to take questions at the end of his address. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm not sure whether I wrote that last line, Jeff, about the AJIA or you did or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's all true. And look, thank you once again for an invitation to come along and talk to you tonight about events on the Korean Peninsula. And there is an old Australian saying, never a dull moment. And Jeff mentioned before the excitement that's in store for you people this year in 2011. I think it's kind of appropriate that the opening address is about the Korean Peninsula. Because the two Koreas can be accused of a lot of things, but a lack of excitement to get the pulse racing events is something that they can't be accused of. What I'd like to do tonight is open by talking a little bit about history on the Korean Peninsula, because I think history is in very, very important context when we're looking at this part of the world. I'd then like to look at some of the key events that happened last year. 2010 was quite a year, in many ways a remarkable year on the Korean Peninsula in terms of significant destabilising events. I then want to talk about what's at stake on the Korean Peninsula. You know, why should we care what happens on the Korean Peninsula? And this is a legitimate question, and the answers aren't always self-evident. I then want to go and talk very briefly about what recent events on the Korean Peninsula, what the implications are, what these events serve to highlight. And I'm going to argue tonight that they really serve to highlight the reinforcement of four significant developments, which I'll expand upon towards the end of the presentation. I think the first thing to note about the Korean Peninsula, obviously it's a piece of real estate, it's geography, it's a geographical area, but it comprises today two separate countries, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, otherwise known as North Korea, and the Republic of Korea, South Korea. Of course, the Democratic in North Korea's title is ironic humour, I think, on the part of the founders. But I think the important thing to note really is that until the middle part of the 20th century, Korea developed as a unified state under a single administrative control and with a distinctive language. And this lasted for almost 1,300 years. So we're not talking about a country that has been routinely divided along ideological or administrative lines. We're talking about a country that has a long-standing history, a resilient history of staying united as a single entity. That said, geographically, Korea's always been vulnerable. It's been invaded no less than 900 times over its 2,000-year history. Obviously, there have been large and small invasions. But again, when we think about the logic and the sense of vulnerability that underpins a lot of the rhetoric, for example, that comes from the North Koreans, I think understanding a little bit of the history and how, in a sense, that is kind of imprinted on the mindset of many Koreans is very, very important. Chinese Confucianism has been a very strong influence on Korean culture historically, and Korea established a tributary relationship with China. And in fact, Korea was one of the most stable tributary states with whom China did business during China's peak as the Asian great power prior to the 19th century. So really, we're talking about a long-standing history here of a close relationship with China, but also many Korean cultural traits have been derived from Chinese Confucianism. And again, it's difficult to understand the nature of the relationship both Koreas have today with China without understanding that close Confucian link. From the 17th century to the mid-1800s, Korea was highly insulated and closed to foreigners. We often think of China as being the country, the key country in Asia that was closed to foreigners and was forced to open up. In fact, Korea was very similar to China. It was called the Hermit Kingdom during this period, from the 17th century to the mid-1800s. And when we refer today to North Korea as the Hermit Kingdom, you know, that really is an expression derived, used to characterise all of Korea from the mid-19th, the 17th century to the mid-1800s. The major powers sent warships to open up Korea to international commerce in the mid-19th century. It was at this point that Korea signed a landmark commerce treaty with the United States, largely as a strategy of defence against its neighbours, primarily against Japan, because one of the key developments in the second half of the 19th century in Asia was the rapid rise of Japan. And this, in a sense, culminates in Japan's surprising victory over Russia in the 1905 Russo-Japanese War, which of course led to Japan being able to project its military power into East Asia and essentially to colonise large parts of the region, and of course that included Korea. So Japan's rise and its victory over Russia leads to the occupation of Korea in 1905. And it leads to outright occupation and annexation in 1910. Japan establishes a brutal colonial rule on the peninsula, which is only broken by its defeat in World War II. And again, when we seek to understand the contemporary nature of the South or North Korean relationship with Japan, very difficult to get a handle on that without understanding the impact of Japanese colonialism, which, along with China, along with Japan's colonisation of China, was a particularly brutal form of imperialism exercised by the Japanese before and during World War II. So the Allies are victorious in World War II. The Soviet Union occupies the northern part of the Korean Peninsula, and the United States leads the occupation forces in the south of the peninsula. And essentially this leads to a division of Korea across the occupation zones, across the 38th parallel. And this essentially reflects US and Soviet occupation zones, a kind of mirror image of what happened in Germany, or sort of a mirror image of what happened in Germany. No kind of ethnic logic to it, but essentially a division of a country as a compromise between the two emerging superpowers. Both superpowers withdraw their military presence on the Korean Peninsula. The United States in 1948, I think from memory, and the Soviet Union around the same time. 2 years later, or around 2 years later, the Korean War begins. And there is some disagreement over how the war actually began. Some historians argued that, the South fired first, that it kind of provoked the North into an invasion. But the general conventional view is that the North Korean army began rolling tanks across the 38th parallel once, essentially, they got the go-ahead from Stalin in Moscow. So the Soviet Union was a key driver, if you like, of North Korea's invasion of the South. The United States, you know, a lot of people in the State Department at the time couldn't find Korea on a map, let alone understand its geopolitical significance in Asia, let alone understanding the history on the peninsula. The Korean War was fought for between June 1950 and 1953, and essentially the armistice, the position all of the forces ended up in 1953 geographically, was essentially the position they started off in 1953. So essentially the war was fought to a stalemate. The armistice was signed. An armistice is a ceasefire agreement. It's not a peace treaty. So technically the two Koreas are still at war because they haven't signed a peace treaty. They're still subject to ceasefire terms and conditions. The key point to emphasise about the Korean War was that it brought the Cold War to Asia. This is the first event that really reflected a willingness on the part of the United States and the Soviet Union to conduct wars on the periphery, essentially wars outside Europe. The view was that if a war was to be conducted in Europe, that risked the very rapid escalation to global war between the two superpowers. So a kind of mindset developed during the Cold War that rather than fight each other in Europe, they would use proxies in what was then known as the Third World to conduct wars, basically wars against each other, but by proxy. That way, limiting the risk of escalation to global conventional war and almost certainly nuclear war. So the Korean War was the first limited war of the Cold War era. So in that sense, it was quite significant from a sort of global geopolitical perspective. For the two Koreas, the prime result was a significant hardening of ideological divisions on the peninsula. This was a war that essentially shored up the power of the North Korean leader Kim Il-sung, who had fought as part of a Soviet guerrilla regiment against the Japanese, who based his entire political philosophy on Mao's dictum, political power flows from the barrel of a gun, and essentially brought a guerrilla mentality to his political purpose in North Korea. This essentially shores up his power. In South Korea, Syngman Rhee, strongman, authoritarian ruler. The impact of this for South Korea as well was essentially to harden authoritarian rule in the South. So neither Korea post-war was democratic. In fact, the first signs of democracy on the Korean Peninsula after World War II didn't occur until the late 1980s. So democracy was in very short supply. And it's worth noting too that almost a tenth of the population on the Korean Peninsula were either killed or wounded as a result of the Korean War. And when we also think about the enormous human impact of this war, we think about the waves of refugees that this conflict created. It had a massive humanitarian impact as well as a significant geopolitical impact as well. Now, to cut a very long story short, both South Korea and North Korea evolved, if you like, after the Korean War in somewhat similar but somewhat different circumstances. Both countries, as I said, were subjected to authoritarian rule, although in the North Korean case, I think it's fair to say a lot harsher authoritarian rule. But the North Koreans took the path of centralized economic development, essentially a Stalinist five-year plan, centrally controlled, repudiation of market systems, if you like, in terms of their economic development. Highly industrialized, are highly inward-looking, highly dependent on the Soviet Union for its trade relations. South Korea, on the other hand, was very much focused, particularly as the 1960s began to develop, on an export-driven economy, outward-looking, essentially looking to replicate what the Japanese had begun to do in the 1950s. As we all know, the Japanese were highly successful in essentially copying export growth models adopted by European countries in the United States. This kind of flying geese pattern of development with Japan out the front of the Asian economies after World War II, you know, was a key part of South Korean economic development. So by the 1970s, South Korea was identified as an emerging tiger economy from pitiful levels of economic growth after the Korean War to, you know, double-digit economic growth in the 1970s and 80s. It was a remarkable period. It was a remarkable turnaround in the economic fortunes of the South. But it's also important to recognise that during the 60s and 70s, the North Korean economy was actually a thriving economy as well. The standard of living in North Korea was pretty good. And really, it wasn't until the demise of the Soviet Union in 1991 that, in one fell swoop, removed North Korea's prime benefactor, that the North Koreans really began to fall into a very, very deep hole economically. And during the 90s, it was frequently predicted that the North Korean regime would collapse rapidly. It was only a matter of years, possibly even months, until this regime essentially imploded as a result of the removal of the Soviet Union, but also as a result of a kind of archaic, centrally planned approach to economic growth and development. And again, this was accentuated by the North Korean experience with severe drought and famine during the mid-1990s. Marcus Nolan has written a very good book on the North Korean famine, outlining the almost unbelievable humanitarian impact that this event had in terms of loss of life. And also, one of the things that will always stick in my sort of memory reading his book, you know, his argument essentially that this will have intergenerational implications because of the effects of stunted growth on new North Korean babies. So essentially, if you look at North Koreans and you look at South Koreans, generally speaking, South Koreans are taller than North Koreans, and that has a lot to do with dietary intake, you know, and the impact of the famine during the 90s. So again, the two Koreas, similar in many ways, dissimilar in many others. And so, again, to cut a very, very long and complicated story short, by the time we get to 2010, North Korea is still with us. We know that North Korea has become increasingly reliant on Chinese support, particularly the United Nations, in shielding it from harsh international sanctions and political legal action from the other permanent members of the Security Council, particularly the United States. We also know that North Korea has acquired nuclear weapons during the 1990s. At some point in the 1990s, North Korea managed to successfully develop the technology to weaponize its nuclear program. It conducts its first test in 2006 and its second test in 2009. And it demonstrates a nuclear weapons capability that, in a very real sense, complements its long-range ballistic missile capability. And it's still formidable, but largely inferior conventional capability, inferior certainly to South Korea, that really, since the 1980s, has rapidly overtaken the North in conventional weapons capabilities. So from North Korea's perspective, nuclear weapons provide a very simple, elegant logic. In a way, they provide a degree of symmetry to compensate for their declining a conventional capability in relation to South Korea and the United States. So it's widely agreed that in any conventional conflict today, South Korea and the United States would eventually prevail. What's less certain is what the implications would be if North Korea used nuclear weapons, if it was, if the regime surmised that it was losing the war, the implications that that would have. So, okay, that's a very potted history. We get to 2010. And there were four events last year that were significant. There were a number of events that were significant, of course, in the Korean Peninsula. Well, four really stand out. Most of the action was in the second, in fact, the last quarter of 2010. But in March 2010, the South Korean Navy warship, the Chonan, Corvette-class vessel, was sunk in the Yellow Sea near the northern limit line. Now, essentially, the northern limit line is the maritime demarcation zone separating North and South Korea in the West Sea. It was agreed, North Koreans contest this, but it was agreed as part of the 1953 armistice that not only would the division be signified as the 38th parallel ceasefire line, but that the maritime zone would kind of reflect the land separation as well. So the northern limit line is the maritime demarcation zone between the two countries. And there are a number of South Korean islands south of that limit line, and I've got to go on to talk about Pyong Island in a minute. But the significance of the Chonan was that it was sunk in a maritime area that is essentially contested by North Korea. And it was sunk in the context of regular joint exercises between the United States and the ROK. The warship Chonan is torn in half by an underwater explosion, and it sinks in 8 minutes, killing 46 South Korean sailors. South Korea accuses Pyongyang of sinking the ship, and a subsequent international commission finds that, quote, the torpedo was fired by a North Korean submarine. There is still a considerable amount of conjecture about what actually caused the explosion. Although there seems to be consensus among most Western observers that it was a North Korean submarine, there is a debate even within South Korea about whether the vessel was struck by friendly fire during the exercises. And questions were asked, well, look, this is a Corvette-class vessel whose role is to actually detect submarines. So it's very unlikely that a North Korean submarine could have surprised it in open waters like that without it communicating that in fact was happening, which it didn't. So there's still some conjecture, and the Chinese are very clear. They don't buy the argument that the North Koreans were responsible. They are very skeptical of that claim. So the Chonan was the first incident. The Lee Myung-bak administration in Seoul responded initially by saying they were unconvinced that the North was necessarily involved in the attack, but quickly shifted ground to blame North Korea. And President Lee himself signaled that South Korea's approach to dealing with the North would become a lot tougher as a result. September that year, the former director of the U.S. Los Alamos Laboratory, essentially the chief nuclear weapons laboratory in the United States, Siegfried Hecker, on a visit to North Korea, reveals that North Korean officials show him what he assesses to be as a highly sophisticated uranium enrichment facility with advanced high-speed centrifuges. Now, why was this significant? Well, it was significant because this was the first time any Western observer had seen what, to Hecker's trained eyes as a nuclear physicist, looked essentially like a facility that could enrich uranium. And highly enriched uranium is a core part of nuclear weapons technology. It was already known that the North Koreans could manufacture a nuclear device through plutonium, the plutonium route. What wasn't known and what came as a surprise was the fact that the North Koreans were so far advanced with their uranium enrichment technology. And the fear wasn't so much that the North Koreans could get a few more bombs. I think the fear is that the North Koreans can rapidly increase the number of warheads in their inventory. And this is a kind of worst-case scenario for, well, not just for South Korean planners or even US planners, but I think the region as a whole, particularly the Japanese, that the North Koreans will, you know, are intent on acquiring over time hundreds of nuclear warheads. It's assessed currently they probably have around a dozen warheads that they could possibly use on missiles. What really concerned people was how rapidly the North Koreans had moved ahead with their nuclear weapons technology. The third event that was significant was the September meeting of the North Korean Supreme People's Assembly, the third party conference. And this, it was significant because this in a way was the coming out of Kim Jong-il's son, Kim Jong-un, who has essentially been crowned, if you like, in a sort of coronation ceremony in North Korea as the successor to Kim Jong-il, who of course is the son of Kim Il-sung. So a kind of dynastic tradition in North Korea, the father-son rule, if you like. Kim Jong-il's third son becoming a four-star general of the Korean People's Army at 27 years of age, and also appointed vice chairman of the Central Military Commission, one of the highest decision-making authorities in North Korea. Essentially what this showed was that succession is occurring in North Korea. Kim Jong-il is widely thought to have had a serious stroke in 2008. There were some who even predicted his imminent demise. And so it very quickly became apparent around that time that succession plans were kind of accelerated. Kim Jong-il is only in his late 60s. So, you know, in political terms, he's relatively youthful. But his health is declining rapidly. And so this kind of signalled that Kim Jong-nam would succeed him, barring any sort of unforeseen events. But it also emphasised the role of the Korean People's Army, the KPA, the military in North Korea, was stronger than ever. The fact that this young guy, 27 years old, never fired a shot in anger in his life, was now promoted to a four-star general in the army, and it showed in a way that this was a sort of symbol of his status, the fact that he had been promoted to four-star general rank, and many are now arguing that North Korea's military actions, the Chonan and the Yongpyong Island shelling in November, was a result of Kim the Younger having to prove himself in the eyes of the military. The fact that he could, you know, take these pretty tough actions, you know, and had the mettle to actually sort of demonstrate that he was a military leader in addition to being that political heir apparent. So on to November. This is when the DPRK shells Yongpyong Island, killing two South Korean civilians and two Marines, following a regular live fire exercise by the ROK military. And the North had been notified of the exercise. Pyongyang had threatened to retaliate. You know, here we go again, the cycle of kind of threats and counter-threats on the Korean Peninsula. But lo and behold, the North Koreans escalate rapidly by shelling these outer islands, about 70 kilometres away from Seoul. Ironically enough, I was in Seoul at the time, attending a workshop on extended deterrence, which is a sort of real interesting irony. A lot of people argue that deterrence simply didn't work, the North Koreans sought to escalate. They were somehow emboldened because the Chinese had refused to condemn them for the Chonan sinking earlier in the year. What are all of these events, why are they significant? What do they tell us about what's happening on the Korean peninsula? And I think I think it tells us four things about the long-term trends of what's happening. It's very easy to get sort of caught up in a current affairs mindset and just focus on the here and now. But I think, again, on the Korean Peninsula, when we are trying to think strategically long-term, it's important to try and think broadly about the implications of all of this. And I think the events of 2010 serve to highlight four important trends that I think are likely to continue over the long term. That is, of course, making a huge number of assumptions about North Korea's continued existence and so on. excuse me. And the first assumption isn't particularly controversial. I'm not really going out on a limb here. And it's this: the risk of armed conflict on the peninsula remains significant. But I think, I think the significance in that comment is that it underscores the importance, more so than ever, of stable, workable deterrence relationships. The events of 2010 demonstrated that miscalculation and inadvertent escalation is an ever-present factor in inter-Korean strategic relations. When I was in Seoul, a lot of the South Koreans I spoke to were basically saying, look, we have taken as much as we are going to take from those, guys up north. We really need to respond, and we need to be seen to be responding, and the South Korean military is much more willing, I think, now to sort of step up and put pressure on the political leadership in South Korea, particularly when it has one of its naval vessels sunk. So I think these kind of events have really put a lot more pressure on the South Korean government. And remember, too, that this is a conservative administration in Seoul. The Lee Myung-bak administration, Grand National Party government, is led by a conservative. And this comes after 10 years of essentially social democratic governments, Roh Moo-hyun and Kim Dae-jung, both seen by a lot of conservative South Koreans as essentially appeasing North Korea. And there is a sense in South Korea today that we've tried to sort of engage the North Koreans, we've sent them, piles of food aid, we've exercised restraint, and this is what we get in return. So I think there's a certain sense that really the South has given as much as it cares to give, and that any further kind of ratcheting up of North Korean pressure, they will feel compelled to respond. And President Lee was very clear in his response. He used the term proactive deterrence. And there was an order given from the very top to the South Korean military that their rules of engagement, i.e. the conditions under which they fire and essentially engage the North Korean military, are much more permissive today than they ever have been. And this is designed to send a signal to North Korea, but it's also designed in a way to put the South Korean military in a position where they can engage the North quickly and from their point of view, decisively. The other point here, when we're talking about the risk of armed conflict remaining significant, is the role of domestic constituencies in the two Koreas. And I've already talked about this role of the South Korean military, which is often overlooked, actually, in a lot of the discussion. But the role of the North Korean military, most North Korea watchers agree, is becoming more, not less, important. Their role, essentially, in approving Kim Jong-un's succession of his father, Kim Jong-il, the view that essentially the North Korean military is largely a law unto itself, Kim Jong-il being very reticent to sort of tell the military to calm down, to actually sort of just exercise restraint. And what the Chonan and Yongpyeong Island incidents show is a kind of North Korean military out of control. You know, I mean, it's an interesting hypothesis, but there are far, there's, you know, there's far worse that the North Korean military did. And when we go back and think about the sorts of provocative activities that the North Koreans have done in the past, you know, the assassination of half the South Korean cabinet in Rangoon in 1983, the downing of Korean Airlines flight in 1987, killing 185 people, the assault on the Blue House in Seoul in the late 60s, and an attempt to assassinate the South Korean president. In context, in broader context, Chonan and Yongpyeong, they're kind of on a moderate level of North Korean, you know, adventurism. But if we expect improvements over time, you know, in North Korean behaviour, again, I think that has been, you know, that simply hasn't come to fruition. The second point, I think, events of 2010 highlight is that the prospects for stable reunification between the two Koreas are steadily diminishing. There was a degree of, I wouldn't say euphoria, but certainly optimism during the 90s in South Korea that, you know, reunification was only a matter of time. You know, we're on good terms with the North. You know, our brothers and sisters will look after them. This kind of, this sort of inter-Korean identification, if you like. I think that's sort of gradually disappearing. There's been no sign of any meaningful reform within North Korea domestically, despite two decades of economic and social decay. Attempts at reform, such as the 2009 currency revaluation, which essentially wiped out the savings of many North Koreans, have been absolutely disastrous. So the regime in the North has totally botched any meaningful economic reform. Its market reform has been minimal and grudging and essentially in many cases counterproductive. So despite urgings from China, the North Korean regime has been very reluctant to embark on any meaningful market-driven economic reform. And the military, as I say, remains the dominant actor domestically within the DPRK. So what would South Korea be inheriting if reunification were to take place? Well, I think it's clear an economic basket case. Who would fund that? It would make reunification between East Germany and West Germany in many ways look like child's play, given the massive disparity between North and South. And sympathy and empathy in South Korea towards North Korea has declined significantly. The events of 2010 underscore this. And I think also, too, when we saw sympathy, the height of sympathy for North Korea in South Korea was essentially during that decade-long rule of social democratic governments that were keen to engage the North and build bridges to the North. And it coincided as well with the Bush administration, which had a very poor relationship with successive social democratic South Korean governments. And if you look at South Korean opinion polls during this period, during the noughties, what you'll see is essentially many South Koreans, particularly younger South Koreans, regularly identifying the United States as more of a security threat to South Korea than North Korea. If you look at public opinion polls today, that switched right around. And I think the Obama factor is probably part of that. The fact that the United States is much more engaged in Asia today than it was under the Bush administration. And I'll talk more about that shortly. So sympathy and empathy for the North has declined significantly in North Korea. So the prospects for stable reunification are diminishing significantly. And I think North Korea's nuclear assets add another dimension to this, making it unlikely that the two Koreas will be masters of their own destiny. Again, in a way, this would sort of confirm the Korea's history, is that there has always been and there always will be a high degree of great power meddling in Korean affairs. South Korean and US forces regularly train for scenarios where the North Korean regime collapses, and they essentially seize North Korea's nuclear weapons assets. It would be interesting, I think, if in fact that happened, if the North Korean regime was collapsing, and outside powers, including China, the United States, to what extent they would insist on taking the lead in any intervention force to make sure that they were the ones who got there first, if you like, to seize North Korea's nuclear assets. And remembering the Chinese share a 1,400 kilometre border with North Korea, they are a major player in this part of the world, and they see North Korea very much, you know, as geopolitically, geostrategically vital to their own security. So I think it's not too hard to imagine the South Koreans, in a sense, the Chinese and the Americans trying to sideline the South Koreans in the event of a North Korean collapse, either to cut a deal themselves, a US-China deal over the management of this part of the world, or to look to seize North Korea's nuclear and weapons of mass destruction assets. And of course that introduces a whole new dimension about potential US-China tensions, likely US-China tensions in my view, in the event of serious destabilisation on the Korean Peninsula. Traditionally we've always looked at the Taiwan Strait as a sort of trigger for a US-China war. I actually think any confrontation in the region between the US and China is more likely to take place over the Korean Peninsula because of what's at stake in this part of the region. Thirdly, North Korea's nuclear weapons program is here to stay. North Korea's behaviour in 2010, I think, can't be explained by its possession of nuclear weapons, but its willingness to really push the boundaries and test the resolve, if you like, of the South Koreans. I doubt whether they perhaps would have gone that far if they were not nuclear armed. So from the North Korean perspective, they see nuclear weapons not only as an important strategic force multiplier against the United States, but also possessing nuclear weapons gives them some sense of security in provoking and engaging the South Koreans as well. And North Korea is not going to give up nuclear weapons anytime soon. The six-party talks have failed to deliver anything of substance. It's confirmed as false the old theory that North Korea saw nuclear weapons as bargaining chips to be traded away for a peace treaty or greater economic aid or something else. It confirms the theories that some of us are actually writing about 10 years ago, that North Korea actually sees these weapons as strategic instruments of deterrence and as vital for national security, not as bargaining chips. Finally, and I'll end on this point, what events last year also confirm is that China's regional and global position will suffer for as long as it continues to support North Korea and for as long as it continues to refuse to condemn North Korea's actions in a meaningful way. There were WikiLeaks revelations that in a cable by the US Embassy in Beijing, back to Washington, sort of relaying a conversation of some Chinese official who said that they would, let North Korea basically, go to the wall if they could establish a sort of modus vivendi with South Korea and help, manage reunification that way. I'm sceptical. I think that's probably, the perception of a US diplomat based in Beijing. It doesn't necessarily reflect China's position. So I think from the Chinese perspective, it's failed to properly condemn North Korean activities because it sees North Korea as a vital geostrategic buffer, not just against South Korea, but also against the prospect of US forces, or possibly in decades to come, Japanese forces being stationed in the southern part of the peninsula. Again, 1,400 kilometer border. China is essentially a land-based power in Asia. It's not a maritime power, as Robert Ross has recently argued, I think quite convincingly. It is not seriously challenging US maritime supremacy in East Asia. But what it is, what it does have, is the kind of land-based supremacy in its immediate region. And North Korea is central to that Chinese strategic set of aims. And it's hard for China to seriously claim great power status in Asia, let alone the world, as long as it continues to support what is essentially a rogue regime in Pyongyang, a regime that's shown that it has disregard for international law, and that it is willing to lash out according to its own internal sort of domestic agenda. Finally, China's defense of North Korea will continue to drive regional states closer to the United States. So in a sense, it kind of suits the Obama administration for the Chinese to be defending the North Koreans in the Security Council. It reinforces the perception among many Asian countries that China, in a way, isn't really mature enough to be a great power. The fact that it hasn't condemned North Korea's activities, the fact that it routinely and fairly shrilly condemns other countries in the region for not complying with Chinese wishes over territorial issues, over domestic politics, human rights, and so on. And again, as I said, the fairly deft diplomacy by the Obama administration, particularly led by Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates, I think has essentially outflanked the Chinese in Asia. And I think, their support for North Korea exemplifies China's, in a sense, its potential isolation in the region as well. And from China's point of view, and I'll end on this, from China's point of view, it's had the rather unfortunate, North Korea's activities last year have had the rather unfortunate consequence of pushing South Korea and Japan much closer to the United States in terms of the respective alliances. And it's also reinvigorated trilateral cooperation between the US, Japan, and South Korea that kind of stalled in that 10-year period of social democratic governments that I referred to. So I'll end it there. I've gone over time, but there's probably time for some questions.
Thank you, Andrew. That'd be most stimulating questions. I'm sure there are, and then yes, so